Reading from Matthew 5, verses 13 to 16. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men. You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before men, that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven.
Thanks, Kate, for reading. And again, let me say how great it is to be here. Really good to see some faces that I don't recognise, and it's great to be able to be here for the first time. So for those of you who might be new, or for those of you for whom it's your first time as well, we've been going through a series in three locations in the Sermon on the Mount. And this week is the next in our series. We've been looking at the Beatitudes, which is really a description of the Christian's life. Today, we're looking at these two statements by Jesus. Two statements. You are the salt of the earth, and you are the light of the world. So we're moving on from describing who a Christian is to how a Christian relates to the world. You could see these as like vision statements by Jesus, a vision statement for how a Christian is supposed to relate to the world around them and influence the world. So vision statements are in at the moment, aren't they? When a new company or group is set up, these days usually a big emphasis is placed on making a vision statement. And it's recognised in the world of business that in order to thrive, a company must have a really clear vision and purpose. So I've had limited experience of vision statements. The experiences I have had have generally been negative, I must say. My first experience was at secondary school. I was involved in starting up Christian Union. We started with lots of enthusiasm and great gusto, but to be honest, we didn't really have a clue. We talked a lot about making a vision statement. Why are we here? But we didn't really get anywhere with it. And as a result, we were never really clear about why we existed. And all of our meetings and activities didn't really have a good focus. So although we started strong, the CU faded away and died for about 4 years. My second experience of vision statement is in the company that I worked for. I mentioned that I worked for an engineering consultancy. It's a medium-sized consultancy, but about a year ago, we were bought out. We merged with a big German company. Before, we didn't have an official vision statement that I know of, but big business prevailed, and now we have a very clear and well-defined set of vision, mission, and values. So let me read you some of them. In everything that we do, this is the vision of my company, our mission is to ask ourselves how we can achieve this in a smarter, safer, and greener way. We enhance trust, we embrace change, we deliver results. Sounds very grand, doesn't it? But to be honest, in my opinion, it makes the company feel a bit less personal and a bit more corporate. And it's not a particularly positive thing for me. But the statements Jesus makes in these verses are not like my bad experiences of vision statements. They're not vague and unfocused like my Christian Union. They're clear and they're direct. And they're not impersonal and phrased in corporate speak like my companies. They're down to earth and they're applied. And that's why I'm so excited to be speaking on these verses here at the Village Church today. Because you're just starting out. You're forming yourselves as a new group. You're forming your own identity. And I looked on your website, you have a vision statement already. Serving the community of Emerson's Green with the good news of Jesus Christ. And that's great, because it's important to be really clear about your purpose, why you're here, especially as a new satellite congregation. But even with a vision statement written down, it's still possible to be a bit unsure about how to work it out in practice. So how exactly should we be serving Emerson's Green with the good news about Jesus? What does it mean to be a church, to be Christians in this community? How should we relate to the people around us? Well, these verses we're looking at this morning are so helpful in answering those questions. And I hope that as we look into these vision statements of Jesus, a about how Christians should relate to the world. They'll bring clarity and focus to your own vision and purpose for being here as a church in Emerson's Green. So we're going to look at three things about these statements. First of all, these statements are shocking. Secondly, these statements are for all Christians. And thirdly, these statements are a responsibility. So first of all, these statements are shocking. You may not have noticed it the first time you read them, but they're actually pretty controversial, these statements, what Jesus says. Just take a look at the implications. So first of all, salt. Salt was a common household item in the days of Jesus. It was used as a preservative. It was rubbed into meat to prevent it from decaying. And nowadays we think of salt as a flavouring, or maybe as something that we use to grit the roads. But in the days before refrigeration, it would have been essential, and it would have been used much more widely as a preservative. It was essential to rub the salt into the meat to stop it from going off. So when Jesus says, "You are the salt of the earth," if salt is there to prevent meat from decaying, what's the implication? The world is decaying. It's like a piece of fresh meat. Left to itself, it will rot and fester. It needs salt to keep it from going off. Now this is totally the opposite to what we think about ourselves. We think we're improving. We think we're on a steady path of progress in an upward direction. But Jesus says, no. The world is going steadily downhill. Left to itself, Jesus says, society will just decay and rot. It's a pretty shocking thing to hear. But the next statement is just as shocking. Light was also a common household item. It still is, of course. But in the days before electricity and street lamps, it would have been even more important. I don't know if you've ever been in complete darkness. It doesn't happen in our lives nowadays. Even at night, there are street lamps through the gaps in our curtains. But in Jesus' day, it would have been much more common, perhaps in the countryside on a cloudy night, to be in a situation of complete darkness. Without light, you can't see anything. So when Jesus says, "You are the light of the world," the implication, again, is that the world is in darkness. The world does not naturally have the ability to see reality. And again, this is totally opposite to what we think about ourselves. We think we're enlightened. We think scientific progress and human reason have given us true knowledge about the world as it really is. But Jesus says, no. The world is actually stumbling around in darkness. Left to ourselves, and without light coming in from somewhere else, humans have no idea about true reality. That's what Jesus is saying here, and it's shocking. But the third thing is perhaps the most shocking of all, and that is the solution that Jesus gives to these problems. Jesus says, "You are the salt of the earth, and you are the light of the world." So who's he talking to? Well, if we look back in verse 1, we see it's his disciples. It says his disciples came to him, and he began to teach them. He's referring to people who follow him, people who are in God's kingdom, Christians. In the original language, the pronoun used here, the word "you," is not actually needed for the grammar. But Jesus adds the word "you" for emphasis. He's saying you, and you alone, are the salt and the light of the world. In effect, he's saying only you are these things. These are massive statements. Jesus is saying the world is decaying, and the world is in darkness, and Christians are the only ones who can prevent it. So these statements are shocking, and you might think, isn't Jesus being incredibly arrogant to make these kind of claims? He's essentially saying the world's going downhill and it's only his followers who can make a difference. He's saying, essentially, Christians are the only hope for the world. What right does Jesus have to say this kind of thing? Well, it would be arrogant for Jesus to say this if he was just an ordinary guy. If one of us were to say something like this, we would be shot down straight away. But Jesus is not just an ordinary guy. And there are two reasons I think we need to take Jesus seriously here. Firstly, the evidence of the Gospels. I don't know if you've read further on in Matthew's Gospel, and if you've never read the rest of it, I would really encourage you to read it. You'll find that Jesus has not come across as an arrogant crackpot. Instead, you'll find him commanding people's respect and even their worship with the authority with which he speaks. You'll find him performing some astounding miracles. You'll find him acting towards people who are rejected with compassion. You'll find him standing up to the religious establishment of his day and exposing their hypocrisy. And finally, you'll see him suffering and dying and rising from death. The evidence of the Gospels means that we need to take Jesus seriously. But secondly, we should take him seriously because these statements are totally consistent. They're consistent with the way that we see God working all the way through the Old Testament. And they're also consistent with what we see and experience of the world. So, first of all, look at what the Bible says about the state of the world. It says that right from the start of the world, humanity has been decaying and in the dark, just the same as what Jesus says. And the reason the Bible gives for this is because of sin. Sin corrupts each one of us. And that's what causes society to go in this downward spiral of decay. And sin also blinds us from the truth about reality and leaves us in the dark. This is backed up as well by our experience. I think if we're honest, we'll recognise that left to itself, society does not get better. We might have more advanced technology than ever, but people are still lonelier than ever. There are still more broken families. We might be living longer, have more possessions, but we're not happy. We might have more knowledge in the 21st century than ever before, but we still haven't worked out how to use it. The world is as much as in the dark as ever, and it's still decaying, and it's because of sin. So when we look at the world around us, we see that the world is decaying. We see that we're not happier as a society because of our technology, because of our advances. We see that this is true from our experience. But then let's look at what the Bible says about the solution. Ever since sin came into the world at the fall, God has had a plan. He's had a rescue plan, and his method has always been to take one group of people and make them into a community in his image, then carry out his mission through them. So that chosen group of people are like a channel through whom God does his work. So if you've got a Bible open, I'd like to turn back to Genesis chapter 12, right at the start. So the first step in God's rescue plan for the world after the fall is to call Abraham and start the nation of Israel. And in Genesis 12 we see the promises that God makes to Abraham. This is what he says. In verse 2, I will make you into a great nation and I will bless you. I will make your name great and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. God's plan was for Israel, the nation of Israel, to be this group of people through whom he would channel his blessing to the world. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you, through Abraham, through his offspring. The idea was that God would bring light into the darkness and restrain the spread of sin through Israel. So, for instance, why do you think God gave Israel the law? He'd just saved them from Egypt, he'd made them his people, brought them into the desert, and then gave them a list of commandments which he wanted them to obey. Why was that? Well, it was so they would show the world who God is by the way they lived. It was so that Israel would be this renewed society in which God was worshipped and in which the spread of sin was prevented. So it's a bit like a show home in one of those new housing developments. I don't know if you've ever been to one of those, new Barrett's home. The developer has built all these new houses, and obviously he wants to sell them, but an empty shell of a house is not particularly appealing to a new buyer. So what the developer does is takes one home and does it up, paints it, puts sofas in, installs a kitchen, so that the people who are looking round can see what's possible. They can visualise what the maker's intentions were for that home. And the nation of Israel was meant to be a bit like a show home in that sense, a renewed society that's been created by God in order to display to the watching world something about who he is and about what life in his kingdom can look like, to show the world what's possible. Israel was meant to be a place where sin was restrained and where the character of God was seen and spoken about. So actually, when Jesus says in these verses that the solution to the decay and the darkness of the world is his followers and them alone, he's not being arrogant. He's not actually even saying anything new. He's just restating God's plan in the Old Testament in New Testament terms. He's saying that Christians are now to fulfill the role that Israel had in the Old Testament. Christians are to be like a show home for the world. The Christian individual and the church community should look and feel different from everything else. The church should be this renewed society where Jesus is worshipped and where sin is restrained. The church is called to be the channel for God's blessing to the world. The church is called to be the people through whom God brings light and through whom God restrains the decay which sin causes in society. It's a big task, isn't it? To be the hope of the world, to be the channel of God's rescue plan. It's a big task to be the people who live life as the Maker intended in order to show the world who he's like. You may be sitting there thinking, I can't do this. I can't be spotless like a show home. This must just be for super Christians, the extra keen ones. Well, no, because point two, these statements are for all Christians. These statements are for all Christians. For a start, look at the people who Jesus picked for his mission. You might have thought, given the huge size of this task, he'd go for high flyers, the people who he could rely on to give a polished performance. But let's take a look at what he does. Chapter 4, verse 18. Let's read who he picks. As Jesus was walking beside the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon with Peter and his brother Andrew. They were casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. Come, follow me, Jesus said, and I will make you fishers of men. At once they left their nets and followed him. Going on from there, he saw two other brothers, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John. They were in a boat with their father Zebedee, preparing their nets. Jesus called them, and immediately they left the boat and their father and followed him. Jesus' disciples are ordinary fishermen, manual workers. These are the people who he calls for his task. Not the intellectual elite or the ones who have passed his test. So when Jesus makes these statements in the Sermon on the Mount, he's not talking to a special group of disciples who he's hand-picked for the task of being salt and light. He's talking to ordinary people. He's talking to all Christians. People who have ordinary jobs. People who do ordinary things. Who have ordinary struggles. Jesus says to these fishermen, you are the salt of the earth. and you are the light of the world. These statements are for all Christians. And that should be a great encouragement to us if we're feeling like this is too great a task. You don't have to be a super Christian in order to live this out. You don't need to meet up to a certain set of criteria. You don't have to be spotless and clean out all the dust from your life like a chauffeur. These statements are for ordinary Christians. We can see that as well from what Jesus has just said about how you enter the kingdom. Look back at verse 3 of chapter 5 if you've got your Bible open. Jesus says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." You enter the kingdom by being poor in spirit. That means by recognising your total weakness and inadequacy. The poor in spirit know they are sinful to the poor. They know that they are incapable of contributing in any way to their salvation. And it's these people Jesus is speaking to, not the self-confident achievers of this world, the weak and the dependents, people who recognise they can't do this on their own. So if you're in that position, that's the right place to be. These statements are for all Christians. But finally, these statements are a responsibility. These statements are a responsibility. Jesus doesn't just say, "You're salt and you're light," and leave it at that. Being the salt and the light of the world is a responsibility. So for both statements, Jesus adds a second sentence, an implication. He says, "You are the salt of the earth, therefore, stay salty. You are the light of the world, therefore, let your light shine." So I'd like to spend the last few minutes thinking about what the implications of this might be, what these responsibilities might mean for you here at the Village Church. So first of all, salt. Salt has a responsibility to stay salty. Verse 13 says this, "You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men." Now, I'm not a chemist, but I understand that, strictly speaking, sodium chloride is a stable compound. If you're a chemist, and I'm wrong, correct me afterwards. Salt can't lose its saltiness. But in Jesus' day, salt would have come from the Dead Sea, and it would have contained lots of impurities. And it is possible that the mixture that would have been used as salt, the sodium chloride could have been washed out of that mixture, and the remaining white powder would have looked like salt, but it wouldn't have tasted or acted like salt at all. And if this powder was rubbed into meat, it would have no effect. The meat would quickly decay. Salt that loses its saltiness is totally useless. And Jesus says that if, as Christians, we lose our saltiness, we are totally useless. So there are two ways in which salt has to stay salty. Two things salt must do if it's going to have an influence. Firstly, and most obviously, the salt needs to be rubbed in to the meat that needs preserving. Salt is useless if it's just left sitting on a shelf in a bag. It needs to be in contact with the meat. Otherwise, it's not fulfilling its purpose. And if Christians are going to fulfill their purpose, they need to be in contact with the world. Rubbed in to the meat, if you like. And that means spending time with non-Christians. It means getting to know our neighbours, building friendships with people at work. And it should be more than just token efforts. It means inviting non-Christian friends into our homes, doing things with them socially, sharing our lives with them, being ourselves, letting them into our worlds, letting them see what life is like as a Christian, inviting them into the show home. If Christians end up spending all their time with each other, they're not fulfilling their purpose. They're losing their saltiness. So, at Village Church, you have a great opportunity to get involved in the community, and it's encouraging to see how you're doing that as a church already. But why not think for a moment, who are the non-Christian people who you have contact with in this community? Maybe it's your immediate neighbours. Maybe it's the mums at the school gates, or the school governors, or the people you work with, or play sport with. How many of those people do you know on a level more than just to say hi to? Do you know what they enjoy doing in their spare time? Have you ever done it with them? How many nights a month do you spend socialising with your non-Christian friends? Doing a leisure activity with them, going out for a drink after work, having them over for a meal, pursuing friendship with them, not just acquaintance. The purpose of these questions is not to guilt trip you, just to get you thinking about how you can be involved in this community, how you can be rubbed in to the meat. If we're not actively engaged in the world as Christians, we're not fulfilling our purpose. Salt needs to be rubbed in. The second way in which salt must remain salty is to retain its flavour. It's not enough for salt just to be rubbed into the meat. If it loses the essence of its saltiness, if it's not actually being distinct from the meat, then it will have no influence and the meat will decay. So it's not enough for Christians to be involved in the world. We must be fully involved, but at the same time, can you hear me? Okay, great. Excellent. So, how do we be distinctive? How do we remain different as Christians? It's about living out the Beatitudes. The Beatitudes make us different inherently from the world. So, the world is proud and self-reliant. Christians are poor in spirit. The world is obsessed with pleasure and glosses over sin. Christians mourn over sin. The world pushes self forward and is defensive when challenged. Christians are meek. The world hungers and thirsts for happiness. Christians hunger and thirst for righteousness. The world bears grudges against those who wrong them. Christians are merciful. The world wants glory for self. Christians are pure in heart in their desire for God's glory. The world is prepared to engage in conflict when it's in their best interests. Christians are peacemakers. The world values comfort above everything. Christians are prepared to be persecuted for Jesus. Christians are inherently different from the world. So, what should it look like to be distinctively Christian at the same time as being in contact with the world? Well, think about being poor in spirit, for instance. It's relatively easy to admit our weaknesses and our sin when we're with Christians, but we're called to be poor in spirit with everyone. So that might mean admitting your weakness and your sin to your non-Christian friends,
instead of trying to prove yourself. What an impact that could have in a world where you're not allowed to show signs of weakness, to have the security to admit that you're wrong. Or what about being meek, when you're with people who are ambitious and striving for success? What an impact it could have to not compete for attention or jostle for position like everyone else, to not push yourself forward. Or what about hungering and thirsting for righteousness when you're with work colleagues who are having dirty conversations or who are gossiping about each other? Not getting involved in those conversations, but instead striving for holiness and purity of heart. What an influence that could have in restraining the spread of sin in the world. Can you see what a difference this could make? If Christians were to really live this out, it would have a huge impact on the world. And Jesus says this is the only way the progress of decay in society can be halted. If Christians, if people in the church, truly engage with the non-Christian world around them at the same time as remaining truly distinctive, this is the only hope for society, and this is the only hope for Emerson's group. So salt has a responsibility to stay salty. Secondly, light has a responsibility to be seen. Look at verses 14 and 15. You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand and it gives light to everyone in the house. So the first picture Jesus uses is of a city on a hill. Jesus was speaking on a mountainside as he said these words, and the crowds would probably have been able to see Galilean towns on hills on the other side of the valley as Jesus spoke, and it would have made his point even clearer. When you build a city on a hill, you don't do it so it stays hidden. You do it so that everyone can see where it is. And the second picture that Jesus uses makes the same point. No one lights a lamp and then puts it under a bowl. That would be a ridiculous thing to do. It would make the existence of the lamp totally pointless. Light from a lamp is meant to be seen, not hidden, so it can bring light to the whole house. Light has a responsibility to be seen. And Christians are meant to be seen, not hidden, just like light. We need to let people see who we are. We need to be in the public eye, if you like, as Christians. That's the only way that darkness can be penetrated, if Christians let their light shine. So that means making sure that your colleagues at work know that you're a Christian, not hiding it. It means when you're in a conversation and the topic turns to faith, not being ashamed of saying that you're a follower of Jesus. It means when your friends ask you what you did at the weekend, being prepared to tell them about church on Sunday and what you learned. It means not keeping your faith within the four walls of church or within your house, but taking it public, getting it out there for everyone to see. And there might be situations where this is scary, where we're tempted to hide the fact that we're a Christian, especially if we know there's a possibility of suffering, if people might be hostile. But Jesus has just said, you're blessed if you're persecuted for my sake. And the fact is, this is a responsibility that comes with being a Christian. We're the light of the world. God wants to penetrate the darkness through the church. Therefore, we must let our light shine. Don't be private. Jesus says, if you're hiding as a Christian, it's like putting a lamp under a bowl. It's totally pointless. Why do you light the lamp in the first place? It means you're not fulfilling your purpose. So Christians are meant to be seen, not hidden, just like light. But there's something more. Light is an active thing. The purpose of a light is to reveal the dark corners in the house, to show what's really there. And Christians are called to reveal the truth about Jesus to the world, to show the world what's really there, the spiritual reality which we're all naturally blind to. This is how Christians are meant to bring light to the world. Christians bring light by actively proclaiming the truth about Jesus. So that means, as individual Christians, we must take whatever opportunities we have to talk about Jesus in conversation. Now, when we think of personal evangelism and this sort of thing, we often freeze We're afraid of not knowing the answers to people's questions. We're afraid of what people will think of us. But this doesn't have to be a scary thing. Just like your vision statement says, serving Emerson's Green with the good news, Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ is good news. Talking to our friends about Jesus isn't a duty or a burden. It should be a joy. Jesus has changed our lives. We just have to bear witness to that and share the hope and the love that we've experienced through him. And this also doesn't have to be a kind of regurgitation of a gospel outline that you've learned by heart. Sometimes we think as soon as someone asks a question about our faith, we have to jump on the opportunity and recite two ways to live. But that's not what it's about. And that's not a particularly loving thing to do either. And it's not a particularly normal thing to do either. It's interesting to read the Gospels and see what Jesus does when someone asks him a question. So in Matthew 19, later in Matthew's Gospel, the rich young ruler asks Jesus, "What good thing must I do to get eternal life?" And we think, if someone asks a question like that, great, let's preach to them. But Jesus doesn't do that. He answers with a question. "Why do you ask me about what is good?" And you'll see that Jesus does this so often in the Gospels. Someone asks him a question and he responds with a question. And this is a great thing to try. When you want to speak to your friends, engage people in conversations about Jesus. Asking questions engages people rather than switching them off. It takes you off the defensive and allows you to find out where someone's really coming from. So often there's a question behind the question. And it's not quite as scary either. So being light means, as individual Christians, talking to your friends about Jesus. But there is a corporate element as well. It also means, as a church, to keep proclaiming the good news about Jesus. And that will involve keeping the Bible central in everything that you do. Always making the proclamation of the gospel the focus of your meetings. But it will also mean being focused on mission in all the activities and programs you organise. Every one of them, everything you do in church life should flow from this aim you have, to serve Emerson's Green with the good news of Jesus Christ. All of the programs that happen in this church should be geared towards getting the message of Jesus out to this community, being light, penetrating the darkness. This is how you fulfill your purpose. So finally, before we finish, let's just look at the motive that Jesus gives us for all this. Verse 16, let's read verse 16 together. "In the same way, let your light shine before men that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven." The ultimate aim in all of this is that the praise and glory will go to God. We should not be doing any of this for our own praise and glory. It might be tempting to want to be active as a church in this community so that people in Emerson's Green see your good deeds and give praise to you. There's something in all of us that wants people to think well of us. But that's not what being here is about. God has placed Village Church in Emerson's Green to be salt and light, to influence this community for good, to be involved and to be different, to show the way of truth in Jesus. But he's placed Village Church here ultimately for his own glory. So that as people encounter you, they'll see your good deeds, but then see beyond what you do to who you're doing it for. The ultimate purpose of the Village Church is for people in Emerson's Green to meet the living God through you and to end up praising him. What a vision statement this is. What a vision statement. I pray that here at the Village Church you will be salt and light in this community, and that being salt you will remain salty, and that being light you will allow your light to shine. Let's close in prayer.